Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we speak with Kent Bain, author of The Most Dangerous Book in the World, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one. New Hampshire legislature reveals U.S. federal government is a corporation operating with a fraudulent constitution. The Act of 1871 created a corporation in the District of Columbia called the United States of America. The act revoked prior legislation relative to the district's municipal charter, and most egregiously led to adoption of a fraudulent constitution in which the original 13th Amendment was omitted. This is referencing the current status of the New Hampshire House Bill 638. The legislature voted to table, mothball, the New Hampshire House Bill 638 on March 20, 2013, and it was to recognize the original 13th Amendment to the Constitution, NHHB 638. Even though the measure had a vote to table it, it brings all this information forward into a legislative body for all to see. If you want to check this out online, just check out New Hampshire House Bill 638. Much of the progressive news outlets online have been discussing the Monsanto Protection Act, lamenting how it was snuck into law, this provision that protects the biotech giant from litigation that was passed by Congress, and the provision that people are calling the Monsanto Protection Act. Again, it's in Section 735 in the bill, the House Bill, H.R. 933. But what's important also is to pull back in the bigger picture, which Michael Murphy and a lot of other people have done, to connect the aerosol operations, Agenda 21, Monsanto, and DuPont, and the other companies who are synthesizing biology, and look at the bigger picture here. One of the reasons it's important to look at the bigger picture is to begin to recognize seemingly disconnected stories. Here's one that was sent to me by Cindy Pakulis of Long Island Skywatch. She sends this email, "They can fix what they cause." And that's the problem reaction solution element. Story is, call for DNA biologists to join the fight against deadly new threats to wildlife. Conservation workers will seek to help form an unlikely set of allies. There's already a spelling error in here. They will ask researchers working on synthetic biology, the science of creating advanced manipulated organisms, to help save the world's endangered creatures and habitats. Threats that conservationists believe could be countered by a new generation of manipulated organisms include the fungus epidemics that are currently devastating frog populations around the world, and which are also attacking bat colonies in the U.S. In addition, ocean dead zones, where marine life has been killed by algae blooms, could also be tackled by synthetic biology, they believe. Now remember, this also connects to what happened in the Gulf of Mexico during the Deepwater Horizon oil catastrophe. Synthetic biology is the technology of designing and building biological devices from scratch. Quote, it goes far beyond tinkering with existing genomes of organisms by adding one or two extra genes. We can now chemically synthesize very large sections of DNA, and that allows us to design biological systems from scratch, just as an engineer designs and builds a piece of equipment starting from basics. An example of the power of synthetic biology is provided by biological sensors that are now being made to check water purity. Here's another story by Jonathan Benson, Natural News. Organic rice farmer in India yields over 22 tons of crop on only 2 acres, proving the fraud of GMOs and big ag. Despite all the claims made by industry-funded hacks that genetically modified organisms and other industrial agricultural methods are necessary for the future of humanity, it is the traditional growing methods that continue to shine through as the real sustainers of life, as reported by Gaia Health. Indian rice farmers using traditional organic growing methods are achieving yields far higher than farmers using more modern methods. In the case of Sumant Kumar, rice yields have surpassed the national average per hectare, which is about 2.5 acres, nearly tenfold. According to reports, Kumar is currently yielding about 22.4 tons of rice per hectare, greatly surpassing that of other rice farms, currently outputting roughly 2.3 tons per hectare. His secret? A traditional crop management protocol known as System of Root Intensification, or SRI. Farmers adhering to SRI techniques will typically plant about half the number of seeds as farmers using more modern methods, and will space them out at intervals of about 10 inches. They also plant their seeds much younger and keep the soil drier, while paying close attention to weed growth. By hand removing weeds, SRI farmers are able to allow more water and nutrients to feed their rice plants, which results in significantly higher yields. The article continues. This is good news, as Monsanto and others in the agriculture for obscene profits industry are aggressively pursuing market expansions in developing countries such as India. If the truth about the benefits of SRI can be widely disseminated, poor farmers across the globe will be well-equipped to reject the lies of big agriculture and the GMO industry. Here's a story in The Guardian by Ian Sample. World's most vulnerable people need protection from huge unintended impacts of radical geoengineering projects. Controversial geoengineering projects that may be used to cool the planet must be approved by world governments to reduce the danger of catastrophic accidents, British scientists said. Met Office researchers have called for global oversight of the radical schemes after studies showed that they could have huge unintended impacts on some of the world's most vulnerable people. The dangers arose in projects that cooled the planet unevenly. In some cases, these caused devastating droughts across Africa. In others, they increased rainfall in the region but left huge areas of Brazil parched. Quote, the massive complexities associated with geoengineering and the potential for winners and losers means that some form of global governance is essential, said Jim Haywood at the Met Office's Hadley Center in Exeter. The warning builds on work by scientists and engineers to agree a regulatory framework that would ban full-scale geoengineering projects, at least temporarily, but allow smaller research projects to go ahead. Geoengineering comes in many flavors, but among the more plausible are, quote, solar radiation management schemes that would spray huge amounts of sun-reflecting particles high into the atmosphere to simulate the cooling effects of volcanic eruptions. Great. The reality is that they're doing it in real time. Those sun-reflecting particles are powdered metals, raining out into the air. You're breathing it in, and here you have article after article after article for the past number of years, bringing in the idea of geoengineering operations into the mainstream media, framed as these are proposed operations, while they're doing it in real time. Here's another story, smart meters, big brother in the home. As the British government controversially moves ahead with its plan to introduce 53 million electricity and gas smart meters across the UK by 2019, more than a million have already been deployed in the UK, which is beginning to raise privacy concerns. Smart meters monitor energy consumption and communicate wirelessly with energy providers. In 2009, a European Commission directive made it a requirement that 80% of European homes have a smart meter installed by 2020. Anything with the word smart in it, you better watch out. Smart meters replace analog meters and are designed to send utility use in real time. They essentially create a home network which collects sensitive personal information, including what devices are being used, when and how they are being used by communicating with appliances, even if they are not, quote, smart devices, and then send that data back to energy providers. Besides the invasive nature of the meters, campaigns also fear that energy companies can control energy consumption remotely and remotely switch off utilities. In fact, anybody with an internet connection and the technical know-how can do so. Mike Mitchum of the Stop Smart Meters campaign cited a recent case where hackers in Germany proved the security of smart meters to be incredibly poor, allowing them to record information about which TV program or film someone is watching on a non-smart TV. This is basically putting our energy and utility supply onto the internet. The data is sent through pulsed microwaves, including 3G and 4G networks, and the potential hazards of sending thousands of pulses per day has been ignored. Listeners, we've talked about how dangerous the pulsing of wireless microwave energy is close to where you live. We've had Amy Worthington on to discuss this. We've had Dr. Perlin Jerry on to discuss this in detail. We've discussed the events of September 11, 2001 in terms of the pile of evidence revealing a signature of the use of a directed energy weapon, and that was with Dr. Judy Wood. On the show, we've also discussed the viability of free energy in the context of 9/11. Well, we look at the same event from another angle, the occult and the dark arts. Author Kent Bain joins us to talk about his publication titled The Most Dangerous Book in the World, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual. Can the awareness of symbol literacy help thwart another false flag? Bain reveals how we're all embroiled in a psychic dictatorship, combining many variables within the dark arts, including black magic, symbolism, high technology, and a compliant media. He also suggests we understand that the same individuals behind UN Agenda 21, the ongoing spraying of the Earth's atmosphere, GMOs, fluoride, are probably also involved in the black magic ritual false flags. Kent Bain, welcome to Another News.
It's good to be with you.
This is a difficult area to study, and but you didn't approach the book initially as investigating the occult. You mentioned that you were going into it to sort of debunk some of the occult references around September 11, 2001. During the process, you had a change of heart.
That is certainly the case. As I began to research 9/11, there were any number of things that just stood out as being odd, out of the ordinary, and it seemed to be beyond coincidence. And so I thought that there would be a rational explanation that I would be able to investigate further, and the oddities would go away, and I would be able to sleep better at night and let the matter rest. But the opposite happened. As I began to look at all of the incongruencies and the seeming synchronicities, there were more and more of them. There appeared to be patterns. There appeared to be multiple occult references, numbers and symbols, and then I really began to pay attention when I noticed those things. And so it snowballed, and rather than debunking what I set out to do initially, I ended up with, I guess a couple of years later, with a book on the subject of the occult script behind 9/11. It was not what I set out to do, but I felt like it was a story that needed to be told, had not been told in a comprehensive, coherent way before, and I feel like it's an important investigative angle to look at the entire event from.
Well, I've heard of this change of heart in approaching a particular topic within a book project. What I want to really talk about here is some of the occult references that you've gathered and pointed out in your book. And let's start off with the significance of 11, the two towers, the Masonic pillars. Tell listeners what you discovered.
Well, throughout the events on 9/11, I discovered a clear pattern where there were numbers of occult significance combined with, in many instances, symbols that were either significance within the occult in general or to the dark arts specifically. And the first attack on 9/11 took place in New York and was on the Twin Towers. And so with that as a beginning point, we discovered that there's a powerful archetype behind the Twin Towers, and that would be the Pillars of Hermes, the Twin Pillars of Freemasonry, or it's also referenced as the Pillars of King Solomon's Temple. in a number of instances, you have these supersized occult symbols, such as the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. It's not just the Twin Towers alone. You see this repeated, and so you can identify the pattern. There's a number connected with this very potent symbol. And 11 specifically is known as the number of magic. And Aleister Crowley, who we'll talk about further a little later on, claimed that number as his own. And, you know, there's probably no one instance here where the listener will say, that absolutely proves it. What is compelling and what convinced me that there was a larger story to tell here is that this pattern is repeated in New York, in Washington, in Shanksville, and in other locations that I detail in the book. And so it's a very clear pattern. It's a very well-known practice in magic to combine numbers and symbols and consecrate various objects with specific numbers. And, of course, with the Twin Towers, the first plane, the flight number of the first plane to hit the first tower was Flight 11. And we can think of that plane being consecrated with that specific number for a very specific purpose. And so you have really a magical formulation, as really a bit of a spell, depending on your view of the dark arts and of the occult in general. But that's certainly the way that it was intended, was as part of a magic spell that was being cast over the area, and really the entire country that day. And the occult script, as I refer to it for the day, really was a magical formulation designed to cast a dark spell over the entire nation, if not the entire globe. One could argue that spell is in place today and continues to be active, and you see how much power that the 9/11 event continues to have in the public mind and the global consciousness. And so it was not just an act of terrorism by any means.
Right. We see 11 repeating, and we know a lot of people who study this area know that numerology, astrology, and sacred geometry are very important to come together for some of these spells to work. However, within the number 11 and, I guess, the sacred geometry aspect of it, the two towers play a significant role as well. These particular towers were offices where people worked, and it wasn't as benign as that. These were specific areas in the towers that were important as well to the larger global market and the bigger picture. But specifically into looking at the two towers as sacred structures, what can you tell us about that?
The buildings themselves were gigantic concrete and steel manifestations of this archetype, the pillars of Solomon. And as you examine them more closely and you begin to look at the architectural elements, the trident is a key feature. It's probably the key feature of the design of those buildings. And you can view them as being wrapped in this occult symbol. They were literally constructed out of these gigantic trident symbols, which a trident is a fire symbol. The trident, of course, is known as the weapon of Satan and of other deities as well. But this in total, really, you can view the entire 9/11 occult mega ritual as a satanic or Luciferian mega ritual. I think that case is well made in the book, and this is just another instance where there is a symbol that is highly significant to the practitioners of the dark arts that is used in a very prominent and powerful way. And so the building itself is a sacrificial altar that is marked with just elaborate use of the trident symbol. And so, you know, they're not just individual symbols that are invoked here, or single symbols. It's not just the twin pillars of Freemasonry. There are frequently these types of things. There are symbols that are interwoven. That's a multi-layered, multi-faceted spell that's being woven together with various components. The building as a sacrificial altar upon which many thousands of innocents and heroes were sacrificed to the deity that was being honored and invoked that day, Lucifer specifically. It was, these buildings were definitely sacred architecture and sacred symbols that were put to a horrific use. Mainly what people saw that day was the collapse of two prominent symbols and two large high-rise buildings. But there was so much more at work that day that we have to dig through and decipher, and so that's certainly what I attempted to do in the book.
The other one other chapter was interesting to me was the excerpt from Symbolic Literacy. It's a topic we cover on the show quite a bit. We've had Jordan Maxwell on the show to talk about this. But Michael Tessarian writes this in your book, and he writes, "Due to chronic symbol illiteracy, we live our lives largely unaware of a great poison in our midst, something that has a profoundly negative effect on our conscious and unconscious selves. This is the use of subliminal persuasion in media and advertising. Subliminal and subtextual persuasion of this pernicious kind constitutes nothing less than a psychic dictatorship." Before you wrote this book, and right after September 11th, you had mentioned that you weren't really aware of this level of occult detail. Can you tell listeners a little bit about how you woke up to what was going on in terms of the occult machinery around us?
I was a latecomer to the 9/11 truth movement, and was on September 11th, 2001, I was as much asleep as anyone else, and I suppose coming to it years later, I had the advantage of a lot of good work and research that had already been done, and then also a fresh eye. And there were things that really stood out to me just in any number of areas, but as I began to research them further and connect the dots, I really began to see a clear pattern and wanted to share my findings with the public. And the cult symbols, the numbers, the symbols themselves are really invoked in a very powerful way throughout the day's events on 9/11. I just had a gradual awareness of this. It was not something that I immediately saw or recognized. There was an educational process, and so I went from being completely asleep to being more awake than I think I care to be at this point. But it was a gradual transition. I had time to absorb what I was finding, and so I have a lot of sympathy with listeners and readers who are skeptical of when first encountering this theory or with the information in my book, because it took me a lot of time to adjust to and to internalize and to process and then to begin to form conclusions and then accept the implications of those conclusions. And it's not a comfortable process. It was a rather lengthy one for me, so in a way, dumping all of this on the reader, I could certainly understand when people have an adverse reaction, because it's a lot to absorb. It's disturbing. It can conflict very powerfully with your, your current worldview. And it certainly does challenge your view of the how the world works. And I thought that Michael Tessarian's writing very effectively encapsulated the whole issue. And he was writing in terms of the overall psychic dictatorship that we're under, and the use of various techniques and technologies for marketing purposes and for behavior control purposes. But what we find on 9/11 was the use of these techniques and technologies in a very profound way, in a very directed way. And I refer to the, of course, the occult script for 9/11, but that is just inseparable from and heavily interwoven with an extremely well thought out, well planned out psychological warfare campaign. And again, that might take listeners aback a bit to think about 9/11 as an occult event and or a psychological warfare operation. But the evidence is very clear. And when you take it in total and you dissect it and then put the pieces back together again and understand what was going on. And so this is a lot to digest. It was a lot of work to research and put the pieces of the puzzle together. But I hope I've presented the information in a way that's digestible, and I try to use plentiful humor to make it as palatable as possible. But the one other point I'd like to make is that I inject humor into the to the narrative, but not in a it's in a very appropriate way, because what we find throughout the script for 9/11 is the use of dark humor. Morbid humor on the part of the orchestrators of the event. And so you don't just have occult references and symbols and this giant spell that's being woven and cast on the global consciousness, but they're mocking us to our faces. They're incorporating inside baseball references and doing a lot of things designed specifically to we would assume amuse those with inside knowledge of 9/11. And so it's you're left with a really sophisticated, disturbing picture that's for someone that has realized that 9/11 was not just a terrorist attack but was an act of false flag terrorism, there is an exponential leap from thinking that it was an inside job to really understanding the depth of the sophistication of what was actually going on that day and the level of resources that were devoted to these various aspects of 9/11. And it is a lot to try to digest it at one time. And so I would suppose I'm still trying to get used to it myself.
Our guest is Kent Bain, author of the most dangerous book in the world, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual. We'll be right back after this break. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kent Bain about his recent publication, The Most Dangerous Book in the World, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual. Listeners, the station still needs your help and financial support. Well, our guest is Kent Bain. He's the author of this book we're talking about, The Most Dangerous Book in the World, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual. And to reference the humor aspect, Kent, that you pointed out, on page 165, you mention an excerpt of Stephen Knight's book, Jack the Ripper. One section of the Masonic notes say humor is all important, and the most appalling crimes may be committed under its cloak. Ghoulish murders with a puckish sense of fun. If Masonic supremacy appears in jeopardy, it is reestablished by a show of strength, by crimes of violence perpetrated to demonstrate the far-reaching power. Well, there are two aspects here, but the humor aspect is something I've seen before, and the retaliation I've also sensed that as well. Mm-hmm. Let's back up a bit and look at the ceremonial and occult significance of the very beginning of that morning on September 11th with the chapter that you discuss My Pet Goat in and the significance of that ceremony.
Sure, that's one of the most interesting episodes in the entire day's events, and perhaps one of the most overlooked. When you begin to understand 9/11 as a mega ritual, as a scripted, highly orchestrated event, then you begin to see it as perhaps a grand satanic mass, black mass, and really that's what we find in Florida, where President George W. Bush was that morning. He was ostensibly on an education tour, but he just happens to be in a location, Sarasota, Florida, that where Muhammad Atta, the ringleader of the 9/11 attacks and the pilot of American Airlines Flight 11, had undertaken part of his training. He took some flight training in Sarasota. He undertook additional training just about 10 miles south of there in Venice, Florida. And so this is, as an aside, this is something that is commonly done with these types of false flag operations, these artificially engineered synchronicities, so that you do a double take. You can't possibly think how you could explain that fact of his being in the location where the lead hijacker undertook part of his flight training. But most people, they can't comprehend the mechanisms that would allow for that, so they just dismiss it. Well, you find that repeatedly throughout the day's events on September 11th. And so there's George W. Bush sitting in front of a classroom, I think it's a second or third grade classroom, and the story that they're reading that morning is the pet goat. Well, if you are familiar with the occult, the dark arts, and you'll understand the significance of the goat as symbolic of Baphomet, the goat-headed deity, and that it just invokes Satan and Lucifer. You've got the commander-in-chief sitting before a small group of children, and they're chanting out this story about a pet goat. The particular style of instruction that was being used that morning, if you have ever seen the video of the reading that morning, and it has a very ritualistic quality. The kids are chanting it out as the teacher taps her pen on her book in time, and it's the whole set of circumstances very much feels like there's a ritual component. But when you see that event, can take it and put it in context, you'll understand that that was certainly intended as a black mass. And the goat, fine, if it's a children's story, the purpose of it was truly to invoke Baphomet on that occasion. And so as there are planes slamming into the Twin Towers and people burning to death and jumping to their death, President Bush is sitting there being entertained by the children who are reciting this story. And the story itself, I argue in the book that even the story itself is a bit of a simplification of the Luciferian doctrine, and I won't get into that during this interview, but you have to read the story and then kind of understand where these the Luciferians are coming from. But it's not just that they're invoking the goat and the Baphomet, but then the message of the story itself has significance. I'm sure they found those that were responsible found it all wildly amusing and probably very satisfying. But so you had the commander-in-chief who was informed during the middle of the reading that America was under attack, and he continued to sit there for an additional 7 minutes while the children finished their reading. All of that takes on a different tone when you understand the things that we've just gone over. And so it was indeed the case that he was presiding over the initiation of this ritual. And while the towers were attacked, he was sitting in front of a classroom of young children who were reciting this very powerful story to him. So it takes on a really sinister nature when you fully comprehend it. And so that's there are other things that are connected to his presence there, other interesting aspects. But that's the overview of Bush as the high priest of presiding over the Black Mass, which was then the initiation of the overall mega ritual that took place on 9/11.
The goat as a symbol. You had the script, the story in that book referencing children and Satan and the devil, and it goes much deeper within the occult. I understand you also mentioned that there was a there's something important about the clown school in Sarasota as well.
That didn't necessarily play a direct role in that day's events, but I did mention it because it's one of the things that odd, a bit spooky connections that and facts that would have made Sarasota an attractive location. You know, there's good reason to believe that the being held in that specific location was a tip of the hat to the CIA's drug running operations, which were have been well documented running out of the Venice airport, which is where, again, Muhammad Atta ostensibly undertook part of his flight training. So there are a whole slew of things that made it, you know, that the location of choice, and that and for Bush as high priest, as commander-in-chief, to be that day. Any one of those facts may not be that impressive, may not be that convincing, but as I weave them together, and then when you put that in the larger context of what was happening in other locations that day, and then the full occult script, you do understand it, and it does make sense. And it's hard to give readers a real sense of it just in a limited interview, but when you go through and you connect all the dots, as I've done in the book, you come up with, you're left with conclusions that you'd really rather ignore.
Just to go down the table of contents, Man and His Symbols, The Pet Goat, Ritual Murder as Mind Control, Let's Roll, Moving Mountains, The Astrological Foundations of the 9/11 Mega Ritual, Connecting the Dates, Gates of Hell, Satanic Sacrificial Mega Altars. Well, that's interesting. Let's talk about that one for a second. What's in that chapter and why is it important?
As you look at the astrology of 9/11, and we've already talked a bit about the Twin Towers as massive symbols, as sacrificial altars, and then the trident as the you know, a key element within the structure of those towers. When you look at the astrology of 9/11, that is a chapter in and of itself, and it takes a while to kind of flesh that out. But there are any number of things that very, you know, significant, prominent alignments. This is not really within the field of astrology. These are not sort of obscure references. They're not a bunch of things that, you know, you really have to stretch to make them fit. I mean, there were some really significant alignments on that day, but not everybody puts a lot of stock in astrology, but there were certainly some interesting facts, just regardless of your opinion about astrology. And that day was a very important day for any number of reasons, and I outline that in several chapters in the book. But when you take the astrology and then you take these, you know, what was being done there at Ground Zero with the Twin Towers, there was a very powerful invocation of the Luciferian spirit through the sacrificing of innocents and heroes on this specific day in this specific place. And of course, we know we really haven't gotten into ley lines and the energy grid, but New York itself and Manhattan and Ground Zero are, you know, very key locations within the global energy grid. So when you combine all of these things, you begin to understand the broader, darker purpose of what was being done at a very specific location in space and time and really on the astral plane, but then also with a very specific alignment of some key heavenly bodies. And it was truly a massive work of black magic. And you can view what happened at Ground Zero and then at the other locations as connected through this act of black magic. And so you might have geographical distance separating Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C., and New York, but they were all connected through this ritual magic that transcends time and space. And the fact that Bush was sitting in Sarasota, Florida, that you can't see that his separation from New York, he was right there. He was and on the occult plane, on the astral plane, his presence was immediate. And all of these things were connected in this gigantic black magic ritual. And so the Twin Towers were sacrificial vessels that were employed on at a very specific location, a very specific date and time. Then you have that picture, but then as we look a little bit further at that area, the Twin Towers were not by any means the only structures of significance in that immediate vicinity. And, you know, we could talk about that further if you'd care to.
Oh, yeah, certainly. You had pointed out that the mass death that occurred was also important for the ritual ceremony to work, to invoke. I know this is not a pleasant topic, and we don't have to go into this, but I thought that was important to reveal what these usual suspects are involved with.
Well, it certainly is, and we are sensitive to the loss of life and to the senseless acts of murder that took place that day. But then when you begin to view these deaths not simply as casualties of war, as the Islamic radicals' war on capitalism and America and freedom, when you realize that that was really not what was going on that day, that was the cover story, and that those deaths were not just collateral damage and not just the results of acts of terror, but that those people's lives were taken as part of a ritual event, and they as part of a mass ritual sacrifice, that's an entirely different matter altogether. And for me, it generates emotions of an altogether different order, because these lives were lost and taken purposefully, and not by Islamic radicals, but by very powerful interests who placed value on these lives as sacrifices, not as American citizens, not as just pawns in a game of terror, but they took the lives in a very specific way, in a very specific location, at a very precise time, for their own dark purposes. And when you begin to grasp that, it's a very unsettling feeling, because you're dealing with something altogether different. The loss of life is abhorrent under any circumstances, but when you understand with what intention it was done and with what purpose, then you're dealing with a really a different matter altogether than just deaths that were the result of an act of terror.
Moving out of New York for a minute and going into D.C., where you had pointed out that the Pentagon symbolism was very critical as well in connection with the number 77, point out that it's a lock and key significance. Can you tell listeners about that?
Well, it's similar to the 11 and the Twin Towers. You had the use of 77 and a supersized symbol, the Pentagon itself, which in context of the occult mega ritual on 9/11, was really a key or a lock that was intended to symbolize the unlocking of satanic forces, if not Satan himself, upon the United States and upon the world, and sort of unleashing the forces of evil. And whether it was intended as a literal lock and key to release a horde of demons on the United States, or if that was just sort of the intent and spirit, and as I described, there's that definite purpose behind that. And so, whether orchestrators of 9/11 really thought they were unleashing a horde of demons, or whether that was just sort of the spirit of the day. I don't really get into very, very in-depthly, but the I do talk about the background of this Pentagon as a symbol a bit, and then I discuss the extensive use of 77 in that particular location. You find it in multiple instances on the plane, consecrating, you know, the vessel, sacrificial vessel that well, American Airlines Flight 77. Then there are any number of other 77s that were just layered in on top of that. Again, you've got this combination of a number of power and then a very potent symbol, and that they're used in a specific way for a nefarious purpose.
Kent Bain, the author of The Most Dangerous Book in the World, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual. And we are speaking about the occult references during that day of September 11th, 2001. It's something we don't often do on the show regarding 9/11. We've talked at length about Dr. Judy Wood's book in terms of exposing free energy to the world. But specifically here, we're talking about the repeated use of numerology, the dark arts combined with symbolism, and how Kent Bain has woven this together in his book and revealed the occult script for September 11th and for false flags in general. Kent, why is it important to know about these occult practices or to wake up to these occult rituals in our midst?
Well, for someone who's first being introduced to this concept, it's a bit jarring, but 9/11 was certainly not the only event of this type. It was the largest and grandest to date in the, you know, I guess in the our history, but there were events prior to that and then subsequent to that as well. By using 9/11 as a case study and fully understanding the different components and elements, beginning to see the pattern and establishing really, if you wanted to look at it as a criminal profile, you can look and identify other events leading up to 9/11 and then following 9/11. And it is part of the architecture of control or the machinery of tyranny that is used to create a perpetual state of fear in the public. For, you know, that there are any number of purposes for doing that, but it's a very powerful control mechanism. And those that employ it do so because it's highly effective, and this is independent of whether you believe there's any you know genuine supernatural element that's at play. You do certain things and certain results follow, and so whether you know the orchestrators of 9/11 and similar events are hardcore Luciferians or whether they just use these techniques because they're effective or a combination, really doesn't matter. The results are very powerful and very real, and this constant state of fear has become a fact of life, of modern life. And it's important to understand what was done on 9/11, not just for its own sake, and to fully understand that event. But those strategies continue to be employed to this very day because there, you have the London 7/7 bombings. Most recently we have the Aurora, Colorado shooting, which many people recognize that there's some MK Ultra aspects to that, and then also the most recently with Sandy Hook. And so, what was done on 9/11 continues. Those practices and techniques and tactics continue to be employed against the global public and the American public. If we do not seek to understand these strategies, we won't recognize them, of course, and we won't have any idea how to begin to resist what is being done. And it's a technologically sophisticated machinery of tyranny that has been constructed around us. And it's not just these types of events that are used to control us. When we look at 9/11 and similar events, unfortunately, those aren't the only techniques used to control us and control our behavior and manipulate our thoughts and actions. We move you know, beyond the realm of false flag terrorism, psychological warfare, into, you know, a whole range of other areas that I know you cover with your listeners. And this is an important element within the push for total spectrum dominance, because it is you know, these are key techniques that they use to control us and to manipulate us. And if we understand fully that what they're doing, how they're doing it, and really some of these very sinister motives that are at work, and that if we understand the character of those who are imposing this tyranny upon us, we will be better able to perhaps not resist in a physical sense, but we will understand better what we are dealing with, because it's not, these things are not happening by chance. There are any number of areas, from pharmacological to chemtrails, and I know, you know, you've had any number of shows on these topics, but this is part of that whole mix. And what we really learn by looking at it closely is that these people who are doing the 9/11 type events, and then they're the same ones that are doing all of these other things as well, and they have very sinister motives. The things that you find that you might think are a little suspicious, and then you dig in and it looks worse, and then it looks worse. Well, it's because there are some extremely bad actors, you know, with very negative motives that are behind all of this. And that's what we begin to see when we peel back all the layers on 9/11. We begin to see the true nature of those that are seeking to dominate humanity. And I think it's important for us to recognize that so we can better come to terms with it. That's my assessment.
It seemed to me that that's what was going on after the Sandy Hook shooting. A lot of people online were pulling apart the official story before it was able to be spun. And then it seemed that there were trolls and intelligence agents online to muddy up the water on that and completely invert everything. It's important to recognize that that's what's at stake also in the spiritual realm or the astral plane.
Absolutely.
That is being used against us. You are a former art director. That was also a very important part of your tuning into the imagery and symbols around you. Maybe if you were an author or writer and you didn't study art, this may not have come your way as quickly.
That's absolutely true. I began to, I think, understand it from a perhaps an aesthetic, artistic, symbolic perspective, and process it visually in ways that then I was able to go back and describe, and I intuited some things just as a result of being a very visual person. I don't know that I would have perhaps rationally been able to pull out of all of the data that I was trying to dig through, and so I've got old pieces of paper that I was, you know, where I was making notes on things, and a lot of the early, I guess, mental processing was visual in nature, and then I had to go back and try to figure out how to translate that into language and do that in a way that was accessible, and where I didn't explain too much or go into too much detail or cover too many different aspects of the occult with relation to 9/11. But I tried to, once I felt like I had all the pieces of the puzzle in place, then I started trying to, I guess, translate that into words, and that was probably the biggest challenge for me.
Now, based on the research, extensive research that you've done here for this book, do you suspect there's another event like this coming our way this year?
Well, I think we would be right to assume so. It's not a given. We can use the occult script or criminal profile that we get from 9/11 and similar events to attempt to make predictions and look at dates that are of importance on the occult calendar, and then look for some of the same things that we've seen in play on 9/11 and in events before and after. But it's very difficult to predict with any degree of certainty what they're going to do and when. Now, the 2012-2013 time frame is very important, according to many esoteric and occult writers. This is the general time frame for the shift of the ages, perhaps even the dawning of a, not just a new age, as in the transition from Pisces to Aquarius, but the resetting of the cosmic clock, the beginning of a new cycle of precession, which is referred to as a great age, a cycle of 26,000 years. And so there are reasons to believe, primarily among them, of course, this is being the year 2013 and the significance of the 2013, or the number 13 within the dark arts, that leads you to really be on high alert for something spectacular on the order of 9/11 or even perhaps well beyond that. And there, I do look at some dates that perhaps we might expect to see something on, but all we can do is give it an educated guess, because one thing you can be sure of is that the orchestrators of these types of events, they do not perform on cue. They do not conform to expectation. If these individuals are extremely creative and innovative, and they will surprise you repeatedly in a bad way. I mean, I've been awed repeatedly by what I've uncovered, and it's not in a sense of reverence, but it is in a sort of horrific way awe-inspiring, not just the creativity, but the level of resources and time, money, and energy that they have to pour into orchestrating these types of events so that there is plausible deniability, so that the average citizen, the general public, will just look right past the clues that are in plain sight, sitting under their nose, and really not ask any questions, while those of us that are more alert will see patterns and begin to figure things out. But so that the cover story works and has enough credibility, and there's enough appearance of appearance of normalcy, so that the public will buy the cover story, that requires tremendous time and energy and creativity. And so we have to, those of us that are in tune with all of these issues, we have to be ever alert, but then we can never underestimate what they have planned next. Whether it's a series of small connected events or some event that dwarfs 9/11, we can't let our guard down. But we don't need to spend our entire life trying to second guess this gaggle of psychopaths that seek to dominate humanity. So we have to walk a fine line between being obsessed with all of this and being vigilant.
If you're obsessed with what's going to happen next or what they're going to do to you next, then that's where they want you.
Absolutely.
Well, Kent Bain, author of The Most Dangerous Book in the World, 9/11 as a Masked Ritual, thank you so much for being on In Other News. It's just been incredibly fascinating, and I hope to have you back to talk more about this and false flag ritual patterns with the listeners.
I'd like that.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for In Other News. See you next week, Monday, 10 p.m. Thank you.